Hi there, and welcome back to Hugo's There 2.0. And this time it's another Seth's Picks episode, which is hard to say, and I had to try that more than once. But you didn't have to know that, but I told you anyway. And some of you may recall that when I set out on my Hugo's There 2.0 journey, I wanted to make some space for doing extra reading that wasn't necessarily connected to the Hugos or even science fiction. So one way that I made that space was by running a backlog, which I've been pretty inconsistent with. So like right now, I've got a great little cushion going, and I'm going to be able to, when we go to Scotland, I'm going to be able to just read whatever I want and not worry about upcoming episodes. But most of the time, I'm pretty bad at that. Another way was by doing my zoomed out episodes where I didn't have to be reading an award winner. That hasn't worked out because for the zoomed out episodes, I end up reading three or four titles. So the third way, and the one that's evidently actually working, was to make myself the Seth's Pick list, which includes mostly science fiction, but it does have a few titles on there. For instance, Pride and Prejudice is on there for a personal reason, and other stuff that isn't necessarily science fiction. And that way it allows me to every now and then spend my podcast reading time reading something that I truly want to read. Not that I've, not liked the podcast reading, but sometimes it's nice to read a thing you actually want to read. So in this case, it is still an award winner because it's a Pulitzer winner from 1986. That is the 1986 Pulitzer Prize winner, which is a 1985 novel, Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry, which is a Western, not science fiction in any way. And to help me discuss this absolute doorstop of a book is Amy Sally from Hugo Girl. Hi, Amy.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here. And so anything new with you or Hugo Girl?
Hugo Girl has been felled by illness for the last month. So we're recording this week. We had to release our very, very first ever recording that we tried to do. We released this month instead of a regular episode. And I am afraid to listen to it. I'm not going to lie to you.
You know what? I really liked it. I thought it turned out just fine. So Kevin did a great job with the editing. I know there was a particular challenge there. And yeah.
There was all, yeah, I won't go into it, I guess. There was like another person that was, it was odd, but yeah, from what I understand, he did a great job. But we're recording on tomorrow. We're recording This How You Lose the Time War.
Oh,
so
nice.
That's pretty exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Do you read a lot of non-science fiction? Now, I already know the answer to this, but for the listeners.
Yeah, I do, Seth. Thanks for asking. No, I actually, whenever I have a break, like if I'm ahead on the podcast reading, I like to do a nonfiction palate cleanser usually. But I actually just read, after I read this, I was sort of at loose ends. I didn't know what to read. And I ended up reading something I probably would never have picked up, but my mother left it here when she was here, but it was The Rose Code by, I think her name's maybe Katie Quinn or something like that. It's about code breaking in World War II.
Oh,
it was just random, but it was great. Yeah. So I love everything. I'm equal opportunity.
Yeah. And I do think there's a stereotype to nerds, right? That you only care about science fiction and fantasy and that kind of stuff. And I think for the most part, it's not actually true, but if there's anybody out there who is just like, well, no, I just read what I like to read, and what I like to read is science fiction and fantasy. That's great. If you're reading, I got no beef, but I will say that reading outside the genre can really be a great way to kind of reset like what your brain wants to take in. And there is some really good literature in science fiction, but there's a ton of great literature outside of science fiction. And so it's good to every now and then expose yourself to something like that.
Well, what's funny about reading a Western, I think, is that, I think it's much more likely that people who don't read science fiction will not want to read it. Like they don't want to try it.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true for Westerns, honestly. Like people are put off by the, I think, premise of this book a lot of the time. Cause it's like, why would I don't want to read a Western. Why would I read that? Yeah. I have no interest in that.
It's a really slow road trip.
It is the slowest. They're going, what, 8 miles an hour?
Something.
Over 3,000 miles.
Yeah. So normally I do like a why this book. And since it's Seth Pick, I feel like I should say why I put it on the list. And for this one, I experienced Lonesome Dove first as the miniseries, the television miniseries in the 80s. In high school, I took a class called Westward Movement because I was at a large enough school that we really only had 2 years of compulsory humanities classes. So like freshman, sophomore, English and social studies or history, and then everything else was elective. And so I got to take a class called Frontier Literature, which was reading Westerns, and then Westward Movement, which was the history side of it, where you talked about Westward Movement and, the colonizer side of history, Manifest Destiny and all that crap.
Right.
And so we actually watched Lonesome Dove for the class, you know, toward the end of the semester, because the teacher was kind of done. But I always really enjoyed that. And I had heard that the novel was good. And so I put it on the list, and here we are. So why did you want to cover this?
This is the fourth time I've read this book. I read this book for the first time, I think, when I was in college. So in the 90s, late or early 2000s. And I think I've read it every time I read it, I get something different out of it. And every time, and I read it far enough apart, you know, the readings are far enough apart from each other that I'm usually in a very different part of my life when I read it, which is, it's just one of those books that just keeps on giving. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every time I read it, there's just something new. I love this book.
Yeah.
And I didn't see the miniseries until maybe 10 years ago or something. I just never wanted to watch it because I had these ideas in my head about what everything is. And turns out the miniseries was just my head on a TV screen. So
it's really, really good.
It's really good.
Yeah. And we just recently rewatched it. The only problem is you can't find it any place where it's in the original television format. And so you get, they crop it to make it widescreen.
That's too bad.
That's a real bummer. But
we'll have to find you the VHS on eBay.
Exactly. I think that's the only
box set.
Yeah. There's something too that I didn't really remember. There's been some long books on the Hugo list, like Citeen, you know, like in terms of the effort that's taken, right? There's a long book and then there's a long book, and something like Citeen, which I ended up enjoying, it took a long time to get through, right? And like it felt longer than it was.
Right.
And then there's things like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, right? Where it's an undertaking, but it's rich from a literary standpoint. And so it has its kind of its own reward there, but it was work as well. Mm-hmm. Whereas with this book, and I'm just going to rip the Band-Aid off and not bury the lead here. I thought this was absolutely tremendous.
It was good.
Such a pleasure. And
hey, me too.
Yeah. And it reminded me of just how great it is to be 200 pages into a book that you're really, really enjoying and being like,
yeah,
I've got another month of this, you know, because what I did was I went through it basically one chapter a night, and there's 100 chapters. And so, or maybe 99, I don't know. But you know, it's in what, 900 page book. I got it in trade paperback. I was suspicious that my reading glasses would work for me because the print is kind of small. But I got new reading glasses and it worked.
Oh, good. I, for this occasion, I splashed out and got a new copy. I'd been reading the same copy since the 90s. So just for you.
Oh, nice.
I got a new copy.
Yeah. I was torn because I liked, you know, I enjoyed my ritual of every night going and sitting in my brown chair that is my reading chair and popping open this giant book and just like the sensuality of it, right? The sensation of the smell of a book and the feel of a very large book. And so I was tempted to switch to the ebook at some point so I could read it, you know, not sitting in my brown chair, read it at the office or whatever. But I never did it. And I'm glad that I didn't. And even then when we went down for our son's graduation in Texas, and then my son and I did a road trip from Texas to Oregon.
Did you take it down there with you?
I did take it with me.
Oh, good.
And my wife was like, that takes up a lot of room in your carry-on. I'm like, I know.
Listen, you got needs must, sir.
Yep. And I finished reading it when we were in Idaho when I finished it. So.
Oh, that's actually kind of perfect, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I read it in unmeasured chunks. So I would sit down at some point and just open it up and I would just read until I was not reading it anymore, you know, until I couldn't handle it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I read like three other books while I was reading this one too, because podcast and whatever. Yeah. So I can't remember how long it took me, a couple months probably, because I kept putting it down and picking it back up. But
yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I would have been able to do just a chapter. I don't think I don't have the personal discipline to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Toward the end, I started reading it in larger chunks. And, you know, this book is, yeah, like I said, it's like 900 pages. And the chapter breaks, at least in the trade paperback version, don't go to a new page. And so you don't even get that dead space padding it out, right?
It's helpful.
It's 900 real pages.
And he doesn't tend to leave it on cliffhangers. Like you tend to leave a person and go to another person or something along those lines. So it's
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in terms of recommending this book, because I do want to, you know, like you said before we started recording, give major spoiler warnings for this one, just because it's such a big book and so enjoyable. I don't want anybody to get spoiled unnecessarily. If you want to listen to the spoilers, that's fine, but I want to warn you off otherwise. But I want to spend some time talking about what's so great about the book. And you mentioned the main thing for me was how well the book serviced all the characters.
Oh my gosh.
Because it would introduce a character and then boom, you've got a full chapter with that character's backstory. And it's not like awkward exposition like you get in movies sometimes, or like character dossiers. I think like the worst version of that is in like the first Suicide Squad movie. It kept just popping up like a comic page. But like it makes sense to, okay, now we're going to follow, we're going to talk about how did Lori come to be in this town, right?
Right.
Talk about PI and so many great characters. And I was telling somebody the other day, I'm like, you know what? I feel like I could write an essay on probably 15 of the characters in this book.
Well, you get to know them three different ways. You know, yeah. you get their internal thoughts and feelings. Mm-hmm. Like he's got, you know, this very special omniscient narrator way of writing this book. So you sort of flow in and out of people's heads the whole time you're reading the book. And he establishes these people so quickly and so well that you're never confused. Like, you know exactly where you are every time. These people are so distinct and so well drawn. So you get their internal monologues. You get a little bit of an omniscient narrator view of them too from the outside.
Yeah.
And then you get other characters' impressions of them. And so they're so well fleshed out that from the get-go, like mm-hmm. I think the first guy you meet, like you have the line about the pigs. And then you have Gus sitting on the porch with his whiskey, I think, right away. And you're like, yeah, no, I know who this guy is. I know exactly who this guy is.
Yeah. Yeah. The book had a preface from Larry McMurtry saying, you know, like he sits down at his
people doctor. Should not read that preface. Do not read the preface before you read this book. That is my cautionary tale to everybody listening to this.
See, I figured it was okay for me just because I figured, since I kind of already knew the broad strokes of the story, just having watched the miniseries a few times. And so I was like, there's nothing in here that's going to spoil anything for me. And,
You were safe.
He did talk about how he basically would just sit down at the typewriter and go, right? And the first line that came to him was, you know, the two pigs were fighting over a snake, not even a very big one, you know, or something like that. It's not so an exact good. Book. Yeah.
He's talked about how, I don't know if this is in the preface or not, it might be, but he talks about how the reception of this book was so different than what he anticipated it being. Like, he felt like he meant one thing in this book and everybody received it a very different way. Mm. And it's really interesting to hear him talk about that. I don't know what made me think about just now, but it's interesting to hear him talk to see what he had to say about that. He has a lot of mixed feelings about this book, but he knew these people so well that it's impossible to believe that didn't like them. You know, he didn't like it. I don't know.
Yeah. Would you give us a quick, like, what is this book about?
Ooh, okay. Oh, gosh. This book is about demythologizing the Western myth.
Okay.
That's what I think this book is about on a very college thoughts level. On a not college thoughts level, it's about two men who have aged out of their ability to be a Texas Ranger, embarking on an adventure to kind of, I don't know, leave what they had behind, new things. Carl is the other character in this book, and he just kind of makes everybody go on this trip. That's what he does.
Right.
So these two men have aged out of being basically what you would think of as a Western hero, you know, like the guy on horseback, you know, taking out the Indians and, you know, doing all the other horrible things that we did. But they're older now. They're in their probably 60s, maybe older.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of at loose ends in a way. They have this sort of livery company. I guess it's a livery company or a wagon rent. I don't even know what they do. They don't rent pigs. We know that they don't rent pigs. they're at loose ends. They're not, this is not the retirement plan either of them saw for themselves. So Carl gets it into his head that to drive some cattle north.
Right. It's just sort of Jake comes along and puts a bug in his ear about, hey, Montana.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think Carl is the most interesting character. He is not my favorite character, but he's the most interesting character because he's so unsettled in such a big way with himself that when Jake comes along and says, you guys should, you know, check out Montana, you can make a bunch of money there with some cows. Like, he was so unsettled with himself that he, I think, sort of projects that onto the rest of the situation. He thinks he's unsettled where he is, but what he's really is unsettled in himself. Right. So he jumps on this idea and just runs with it, hoping to outrun something, I think. And then the rest is history.
Yeah. And so from an actual like plot standpoint, right, you've talked about more the thematic part of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, plot wise, these guys get a whole bunch of cows, they get a whole bunch of cowboys, and then they go up the trail. They go from Texas to Montana. And then along the way, you know, they meet tragedy, they meet joy. They, you know, there's a lot of adventures that happen on the way. There's a lot of introspection. You get to know a lot of the people on the trail, and then things culminate.
And it's so skillfully done too, the way, because you don't just have the main group, right? You have Lori and Jake are their own kind of offshoot group. And then you have, July Johnson. Yes. Yeah. And his whole side of things.
Yeah.
And everything weaves through and eventually meets up. Right. And that's just, that's really well done. I really admired the way all that worked.
My favorite thing about the plot of this book, I think, is how almost everything that happens is instigated in some way by a woman. So the women in this book are a tragic bunch of people, except for Clara. She's probably, I think, the closest thing to a hero in the book.
Clara is awesome.
I know, she's the best. But they all, so Lori makes Jake go on the trail because she convinces him that she wants him to take her to San Francisco, right?
Right.
I don't know if, I think Call made the decision to get on the trail because of his unexamined issues with
big time
the love of Maggie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Gus gets on the trail because he wants to see Clara. That's it, right? And then July Johnson sets out, I think originally because Jake killed somebody, but
right because his sister-in-law Peach.
Oh yeah, Peach makes him go. That's right. Yeah. So that's another one. And then he stays out because of Elmira, basically.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's fascinating to me how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like these men who are so hard-nosed and masculine, you know, really their decisions are all based on these women, which is pretty interesting.
Well, and there's a lot of, you know, the more expected cowboys chasing women in cities or towns, really, right, as well.
Oh yeah, but there's a healthy amount of womanizing that you can take in while reading this book.
Yeah, and I will say, in terms of trigger warnings, some really terrible stuff happens.
It's not for the faint of heart.
No, there's the what happens to Lori is just, it's tough.
It's awful. And I think what happens to Janie before she runs away, what's happening to her is really bad.
Yeah. And McMurtry has such a way of getting you to just love these characters in a short time. And then sometimes you're like, oh, I wish I didn't love that character now because they're gone.
Because don't get attached.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of my, I have four open-ended questions at the top of my notes list. And one of them is, which death is the worst?
I mean, we're getting almost into spoilers, I think. Let's back up and we'll go to that after we go to spoilers. How about that?
Okay.
So yeah, in terms of like why to read this book, I've got a list of, I don't know, 1, 2, 3,
woof,
close to 20 characters, and I could talk to you at length about most of them. And that's how well served the characters are. And it's not the kind of thing where it's like super like random, where it's just like, okay, and now we're going to do 700 pages on Lori, right? It's just like a chapter that helps you understand this character. And then for the rest of the book, that's setting that context for the character. And it diverges here and there, but it's never like that, oh, I wanted to get back to the other plot, because the other plot is just them going north.
Right. I mean, the plot in the book, I mean, there's a plot, but the plot in the book is really these people, right? I mean, that's what you're there for. It's a character study at the end of the day. And I think it's amazing that for a, whatever, 5,000 page book, almost nothing, I mean, I would say almost nothing is wasted, right? Every time you are with these characters, something happens with them, or they're talking about someone else, or something is happening that gives you more insight, right? Or gives you a glimpse into how they're changing or not changing. And it's a very tightly written book for as long as it is.
I was going to use that exact word. I'm like, I wouldn't usually use the word tight to describe a 900 page book.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's a saga.
You do have to be on board with some, you know, descriptions of sweeping vistas and things like that. But
you do,
you know,
chaparral. You get lots of uses of the word chaparral, at least early in the book, because that's why they're in Texas.
Is that how you pronounce it? I thought it was chaparral, but I am not from the West. So.
Somebody who knows more than us, let us know.
It's something pokey and sticky in the West, in the desert.
Yeah, underbrush, more or less.
Yeah.
Yeah, nasty stuff. No, it wouldn't be fun to try and ride through, I don't think.
Or walk through. I think, if I were going to talk about why to read this book, though, I think one of the things I would say is I have rarely read a book that is so deft at showing the difference between someone's inner life and an outer life, right? What they're thinking and what they do.
Yeah.
And how dissonance between those two things can matter. Right.
Mm.
That's the best part of it to me.
Yeah.
Is they're just people, right? They're just people doing their thing. And it's, I don't know how else to put it. It sounds very, you know, mundane, but it's really impressive.
Like there's a lot of flawed characters as well, but they make sense.
Oh, everybody's flawed. Yeah. Nobody's good.
You think of somebody like P.I., and I don't think this is really a spoiler.
Oh, bless his heart.
I love him so much. And
that's my favorite shift when they go to, whenever he goes into P.I.'s head.
Yes.
That's my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, you know, he's not the sharpest tool in the shed.
No.
He's loyal to a fault though. Like where he's so loyal to Call that like he's thought it might be nice to get married sometime, you know, but he's terrified of women. And I love this quote. I'm just going to read it. And you know, he doesn't want to marry because Call isn't married and he thinks it might bother him if P.I. gets married. Right. But I love this, but once in a while, even if nobody mentioned one, the thought of women entered his head all on its own. And once it came, it usually tended to stay for several hours, filling his noggin like a cloud of gnats. Of course, a cloud of gnats was nothing in comparison to a cloud of Gulf Coast mosquitoes, so the thought of women was not that bothersome, but it was a thought P would rather not have had in his head. I just love the way it weaves through there.
Now that I'm thinking about it, P.I. might be the only one in the book that inside and outside is exactly the same.
Yes.
You know what I mean? He might be the one that has the least amount of pretense about him. Mm-hmm. He's such a simple person, right? He sees, he does, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Late in the book, he and Gus are in a tight spot and Gus is like, you know, I might need you to shoot. And he's like, you know, I'm not that good to shooting unless I got time to aim. Like, he's just so honest.
I know. And most men are like, yeah, I'm the best shot in the West or whatever, right?
Yeah. Well, it's in contrast to Jake, right? Who has this reputation of being a sharpshooter because he got off one lucky shot one time.
I think my favorite PI, one of the parts of the book that moves me the most, and I don't know if this counts as a spoiler or not, there is a point in the book where PI has to go on a very long walk.
Yes.
And he is in a bad situation when he goes on this very long walk.
Very much.
And I get so moved by this very simple person, his determination to do the thing he has been asked to do, and the thoughts he has about what people would think if they saw him, or like it's very touching. The whole thing is just very touching and kind of pathetic, you know.
He is naked at the time.
I know, bless him. You know, that's based on something real. Can I tell you this?
Oh, really?
I don't know if I wrote it down, but Call and Gus are loosely based on Charles Goodnight and Oliver. What's his last name? Oliver Loving. I don't know if you know who those guys are, but they basically Charles Goodnight was a ranger and he wanted to drive a bunch of cows north, and he met Oliver Loving kind of on the way, and he was sort of a rancher guy. So these two guys did this trip, right? And in the end, I think Charles took Oliver's body all the way back to Texas. It was like that.
Oh, okay.
And PI's little journey is something that happened to one of those guys. They had to do that. They had to walk away from ambush and go find the herd.
Walk 40 miles with no provisions. Yeah.
Days and days. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, which I thought was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're saying read this book. The characters are amazing. You know, it is a road trip and it's a pretty slow one. And I'm not saying slow as in the book is slow paced.
No, those cows can't go very fast.
The reality is, that it takes them a long time. My son and I did it in a car in 4 days, but without a car, it takes longer. And it was fun. Right. Like, we're like, hey, we're crossing the Brazos, right? We're crossing the Red River. So
isn't that amazing? I looked up their route. I tried to look up their route on the internet to see, so you can kind of picture where they were. Because I tend to put in my head when I'm reading the book, I tend to put them way further east than they are for some reason.
Oh yeah. They're starting off in West Texas. So
yeah, they're in the middle and then they go west. They go further west. There is so much more America than you think there is. And I do think it's interesting that I like learning about the history, like the loose historical references in the book. And so it's interesting to read about what parts of their journey were real and which parts couldn't have happened. Like the railroad was in their way, for example, that it should have been in their way. It should have been where Clara lived essentially.
Yeah.
And they never see it. I think that was interesting, but so they have these cows can only walk 8 miles an hour, and they go 3,000 miles from the south of Texas to Canada.
Yeah. It's essentially all
insane.
The way to Canada. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go ahead and get over into spoilers and
yay.
You know, we're going to talk about key character moments and character deaths because there are those. And I wrote down so many quotes. I love the one from Gus.
Oh, good, because I am so bad at that. I do have three Gus witticisms and a whole treatise on Uva Uvam Vivendo Varia Fit, which is at the bottom of his Hat Creek Cattle Company sign. It's Latin. It's a great motto, whatever it says. I'm glad you wrote some stuff down because I'm very bad at that.
Yeah, I like a couple. This one I can definitely relate to, having recently been in Texas. I know you live, you know, in Atlanta, and it can get pretty hot there. It's actually quite warm. We've had a warm spell here in Oregon where, you know, was over 100 for several days in a row. And to us, that's apocalyptic. this quote is, "I'm sure partial to the evening and the morning. If we just didn't have to have the rest of the darn day, I'd be a lot happier."
I feel that way every day, every day, Gus.
I mean, there is something really nice to, you know, after sundown, someplace where it's been really warm during the day.
Oh man, and that's such a good feeling.
Yeah, it's so great.
It's like things just, they go, the temperature drops 30 degrees, like immediately when the sun goes below the horizon. And then especially in the summer, you still got a whole lot of day left and you can just chill. And yeah, I love that. I love that part of the day.
Yeah.
I wish that Gus would show up with some biscuits in the morning though. If I'm going to be getting up early, he has those sourdough biscuits. One of the saddest things in the book is that he doesn't take his biscuit maker with him. Biscuit maker.
Yeah. Oh, his Dutch oven.
It's a Dutch oven. Yeah.
I really want to try those. And I have found recipes online for Gus's sourdough biscuits. And I'm like, I might have to do that sometime because they do sound tremendous.
I mean, you can make buttermilk ones kind of the same way if you didn't want to have to go through the whole sourdough thing.
Yeah, I make buttermilk biscuits all the time. And
in a Dutch oven, Seth?
Not in a Dutch oven.
On a fire?
No, that would be good. Just normally in my oven. Another one.
That's probably a good call, actually.
that I thought was funny, just like from a stereotypical man point of view, is the quote, "It's just that it's fearsome for a man to have a woman start thinking right in front of him. It always leads to trouble."
My Gus witticisms were the deeper ones. The one that I wrote down, I wrote, "It ain't dying I'm talking about, it's living. It matters. I doubt it matters where you die, but it matters where you live." Mm. That's a good one. And then the one that I always come back to is, "The earth is mostly just a boneyard, but pretty in the sunlight." Mm. I love that one.
Yeah. Yep.
The last one is, "If you only come face to face with your own mistakes once or twice in your life, it's bound to be extra painful. I face mine every day. That way they ain't usually much worse than a dry shave."
Oh, dry shaves are rough. another is, do you want to just kind of run down the characters? I mean, sure. I think if we try and go through all of them, we're going to be here for 3 hours, but yeah. So Gus is this much more, you know, he's not taciturn, right? He's loquacious, right? He's going to talk your ear off, and it annoys the hell out of almost everybody. But until he runs into somebody like Poe Campo, who can hold forth as well, and then he finds him really annoying, which I thought was great.
I liked the Gus Wilbarger scenes.
Yes. When
because Wilbarger was sort of like Gus, but not as good. And so he would he had a very, it's like Wilbarger was like, if Gus and Call had a baby, I figure like it would be Wilbarger.
Yeah, yeah. Where he's just like on the edge of being super annoyed by Gus, but then but there's something about listening to this guy talk. Right. That's one of the bummers in the miniseries is Wilbarger is basically completely gone.
Oh, that's right.
And he's an important connecting character.
I like him because, you know, you get sad about, well, I guess we're doing spoilers. So Joe is a kid. Joe dies. Mm-hmm. Joe had an opportunity to leave his path to this death at one point by working for Wilbarger. And I think it's interesting that even if he had left and gone with Wilbarger, he probably wouldn't have lived. Like he was sort of destined to die.
Wilbarger ends up getting taken out by.
Yeah. And I think people he was with did too.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you had a, we're going to circle back to something that we decided not to go into spoilers. You had an open-ended question.
Yes. Oh, it was which death is the worst?
Yes. And my answer for that would probably be Joe, just because of the lost potential. Yeah. And just because like Elmira is the character I have the least empathy for, because I don't understand. I mean, to some extent I get it, right? She married the good guy, but she wants the bad boy, right? It's a trope.
Yeah.
Right?
And I also think that she's an example of a lot of these people have had the empathy drained out of them, you know? Over the course of their lives. Like who knows how she started? We don't really understand. We don't really get how she started her life.
We kind of do know how, we know where she ended up before marrying.
Yeah. Yeah. She was with D and she was making time with D-Boot.
Yeah,
she was working girl. She was a sex worker. We don't know how she became a sex worker. That's the thing. But we do know that she was treated very, very badly by some very, very large men. And I think that, and this, who knows what she would have done if that never happened. But I do think it's important to remember that some very, very bad things have happened to this woman. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's, her and Lori both have this intensity to reach some destination they think will be better. Right. I don't like where I am now. And I think a lot of the people in the book, they're always thinking about where else they'd rather be. Right.
Yeah.
But Lori and Elmira are just driven to go to this other place.
Except Dietz. He wants to go back.
But it's somewhere else than where he is. Everybody wants to be somewhere else. But I think Elmira, I don't have a lot of sympathy for Elmira, I think, because, you know, she doesn't treat July well. She doesn't treat her son well.
She doesn't really have any use for either of them, right?
No, I mean, she doesn't have use for much of anybody, really, except for to the extent they can get her where she wants to go, right?
Yeah.
And July like and her, Joe were in her way. So.
Yeah, and trying to reconnect with Dee is, she's trying to get back to that part of her life she remembers.
Yeah,
that I guess was more exciting.
And I think a little more joyful, honestly. Like it was, I think, her best version of safety. So for whatever reason, she doesn't feel safe with July, right? She feels out of place and she doesn't like him as a person because he's July. He's just a very passive person and she doesn't like it, right?
Yeah, so he's solid, but kind of passive.
I don't know. Elmira's a tricky one to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe, he had just gotten a hold of a gun. He was like on the precipice of leaving his childhood, right?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, Janie had kind of already left hers far, far behind.
Yeah.
And poor Roscoe is just so bumbling. But those three, their deaths are so pointless and they are so unnecessary. And I feel like one of the biggest neon arrows in the book to know Old West sucks. Here's why, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they just happened to run across Blue Duck and, you know, he just wanted to kill people.
Right. I mean, I think my worst one is Dietz.
That is a tough one. Yeah.
Because
there's no justice to it, right?
Where he
is trying to do a good thing. And because Gus and Call know him so well, they know this is a good guy. He's coming, he's returning this blind baby, right? to the folks who are with him. And because they know how they would respond to Dietz, they're slow on the draw and aren't able to keep him from being killed.
Yeah.
And
he's just such a gentle soul that it's just sort of, it's his whole life feels like a tragedy. And you know very little about it, but you get the sense that there was injustice. He's based on a guy who ran with Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving named Bose Eichard, one or the other. Mm. But he was he was enslaved in Mississippi and then went and joined up with, I think, Charles Goodnight. And Dietz's epitaph that Call puts on that gravestone is essentially what Charles Goodnight wrote about Bose when Bose passed away. And he wrote it in his diary, I think, which is, it's fascinating to see a man like that try to come up with tender feelings, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And what he comes up with is so inept, you know?
Yeah.
It's both really moving and awfully, and just not enough. You know?
Yeah. And Dietz is one of those characters too, because of, you know, there is some just casual racism, right? Where somebody's like, well, I'm supposed to take the orders from Dietz, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet he is always shown as so competent and like, you know, the other guys just respect him so much that it's like they've moved past it, right? Where there are still people who are stuck in old prejudices.
Which is an interesting, sort of portrayal of, I call it macro racism versus micro racism, which is, I think, something that happens a lot in the southeastern United States, is where people have sort of a unspecific idea of how a type of person is, right? Or a group of people are, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then when they actually meet people face to face and they get to know them, right? They don't, that's not what they think, right? They don't think that about this person. But they continue to maybe think about it as the people as a whole.
Yeah, and you can get into some of the soft racism of low expectations, right? Where you get the person who's like, "Wow, he speaks really well." You're like,
okay. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely things to say about how Dietz is portrayed. I don't think that he, I think McMurtry definitely has a lot of respect and empathy for him in the way he writes him. Mm-hmm. But I think the first time we meet him, the description we get is about his white teeth, which is problematic. I'll just say that.
Yeah. So in terms of favorite characters, I love Newt. He cries so much.
He cries so much. He cries the whole way up the trail.
Yeah. I mean, part of it, you know, some of it is, you know, and he suffers too, right? Because he's back in the sweeps. Is that what they call it? Where he's back at the very back. And so he's just eating dust all day, every day.
Poor guy. And he's just so, like, he's so intent on impressing Call. And of course, that means he's constantly screwing up. And he's just such a little boy, you know, until he's not, right? Until he is not. He grows up very quickly when Gus... are we doing spoilers?
Yeah, we're in spoilers.
Okay. Yeah. So Call is Newt's father, but Call won't acknowledge it. And so Gus tells Newt at some point on the trail, he sort of starts pebbling it in. He's like, making a little reference and then not talk about it again. But he does finally talk to Newt about it. And I think that's sort of when Newt's interesting, because he goes from having no family to having a pretty good found family on the trail to finding out how disappointing real family can be. And his arc is so tragic. And the preface to this book spoils what happens to him in a different book, which is one of the worst things I've ever read in my life. Oh. I can't believe Larry did that. Larry.
I think I might've missed that. So,
oh, do you want me to tell you?
No.
Are you going to read the rest of them?
I'm not sure I will. I thought all the rest of them were prequels.
No, there's one that's post. And then I think there's two prequels in one post. I think, I can't remember the names of them. I started reading the sequel and I put it down 5 pages in because I was so mad about what he was doing to the characters. So I can't say that I can't say I recommend them. But Newt, something happens to Newt in the next book. And it's awful and ironic. And I don't know. If you don't want me to tell you, I won't tell you. But
I'll go check out the preface maybe later. Newt, like, he does mature a lot along the way, right? Where
he does.
Where he's getting more and more responsible. You know, at the beginning, he's the eager kid who wants to, you know, can you bring me along when you go down to Mexico to get all the cattle and everything, you know? And he's a little bumbling. He loses his horse at some point, or gets dismounted, or gets knocked off his horse, right? Which nobody could blame him. It's a stampede.
Also, the death of Mouse is very sad.
Oh, yeah.
That's his horse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he does. And especially when they get up to Montana, Call suddenly just makes him in charge. He's like, well, you were a kid until yesterday, and now you have to be the man.
Yeah.
Which is too much. You know, it's like he goes from getting nothing from Call to getting entirely too much. And it's like he just sort of crosses the Rubicon into adulthood at some point, and that's it, right?
Yeah, well, and he really becomes very much Call's son, because Call, for various reasons, we can talk about it, cannot admit that Newt is his son, because that would that would admit a personal failing, right? But Newt can't put the question to him either.
No.
If Call won't come out and say it, he won't ask him, even though he knows. and I thought that was really interesting, a parallel between them.
Yeah. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, he's becoming a little baby Call at the end. Mm-hmm. And for better or worse, I don't know. I don't know if I would say Call is a good man. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure I would say he's a bad man, but when you are that rigid, it doesn't work. You know, it doesn't work for the world. I don't know.
Because, you know, he had this relationship with Maggie, right? And there was something about her that broke down his defenses, because he was immune to the charms of the sex workers, right? I will say the book uses the word whore.
It sure does.
A lot.
It sure does.
And so if that's a word that's going to, I apologize for using
it. I might slip up too. No, I might slip up too, because it's everywhere.
It's one of the last words in the book.
And in a way, I feel like that word applies a little more to what's happening in this book than sex worker in a way. I mean, obviously sex worker applies, but I don't know how much agency you can give to these women choosing this life, right? They're doing what they have to do. So in that sense, there's agency, but it's...
And it says, like, Lori, she's pretty choosy. Well, not pretty choosy.
Oh, yeah. Refuses to be... I've read a good quote about her. It was like, she completely refuses to be a prize for the moon-eyed cowboys who keep falling at her feet.
Yeah.
Which I love. Yeah. But you were talking about Call and Maggie.
Yeah. he's this man of convictions, and because of his convictions, he can't be honest with himself about Maggie, that she was important to him. Mm-hmm. And because he feels that he went to her out of weakness, now he can't go back to her. And so he doesn't see her, and then she dies.
Mm-hmm. And it's so pointless. Like everything, yeah. It's like you were so close to being able to be happy.
Yeah.
You know, if this same woman was put in front of you, walking out of a church, right?
Mm-hmm.
It probably would not have had, he wouldn't have gone down the same road, right? It's just this belief about who he is supposed to be. And that doesn't include a person who goes to sex workers, right?
Right. And it's not like he's, you know, religious or anything either.
Right. You know, and it's also something about just needing a woman. I think, is there something about that too, that is anathema for some reason?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a proto toxic masculinity.
Oh boy. I could talk about masculinity in this book all day, Seth. My favorite thing though, is that Col and Gus are our two, those are our two, I think, anchors in the book.
Yes. Yeah.
And Gus is running around trying to be a romantic, and he's constantly slapped in the face by reality. Mm-hmm. And Col is running around trying to be Mr. Practical, and he's constantly slapped in the face by romance, which is awesome.
Yeah. I think at some point I think I was telling you that I had finished the book. I think it, your reply was Gus.
There's not a single heroic death in this whole book. And Gus's is, I think, one of the least heroic ones that there is.
It's funny, too, because like the McMurtry doesn't make him out to be this super stubborn character, right? He has a lot of the heroic tendencies, right? If somebody needs to go in and kick some ass, he's going to do it, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, he likes the ladies, and then all of a sudden he's like, nope, I don't want to, you know, have no legs.
I think it is actually so fundamentally true to who he is, though, to make that call, because he has this romantic ideal of how he wants to, who he is, right?
Yeah.
He's the cowboy philosopher, right? He's the one who can charm Lorena into giving him a free poke or whatever, right? Right. He's writing Latin on his Hat Creek outfit signs. I don't know. He has this idea, and I think being a man with no legs is not in his plan, and he is not, it's too much reality for him. Yeah. He'd rather bow out than,
I think you're right.
Than put in any work to get used to anything else. Right. He's not a man who works. Mm-hmm. He's not a man who puts in any effort unless it's, you know, going dashingly off the woman who got carried off by Blue Dog. You know what I mean? It's like,
I think it keeps him from having to later in his life admit that it's over. Right. We'll just go, we'll go out now. He doesn't want to ever face a point. And, you know, I understand this. I'm in my 50s now. Like I see retired people and like my mom is 80, right? I mm-hmm. see people facing the, mm-hmm. I'm not what I was. Right. And these men
were already wrestling with that too. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's one of the central themes of this book, is that these men don't know what to do when they're getting old. Right.
Yeah.
They're men of action. Mm-hmm. And if they can't be men of action anymore, then who are they? And Gus decides he's not, he's just not a man of action. So I do love that he leaves his money to Lori, and that Col does it. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Who do you want to talk about next? You want to talk about Lori? I mean, Lori and Jake are kind of a package deal.
Oh, see, I disagree.
I mean, yeah, I understand that as well. Right. Because Lori is a much better character than Jake. And like, he is so pathetic.
Jake is the worst.
Yeah.
He's the worst.
He is.
Jake shows up on his fancy horse, having just killed a guy. He's like, my mistake is now going to bring everybody else down, is basically what happens.
Yeah.
Like, that's what happens. He brings his crap over to Col and Gus, and then it ends up putting them on this path, right?
Yeah. Because he like accidentally shot off a round. It went through a wall and killed the mayor of the town.
So dumb. Dentist. He was a dentist.
Dentist. That's right. But wasn't he the mayor as well?
Oh, was he?
I think he
might have been. I think you're right. Jake,
and,
man.
And so he's on the run. And he's just soft, right?
And he's so selfish, right? He doesn't think past his own nose at any time.
Yeah. Well, he thinks a little further south than that, but.
okay, fair.
Yeah. You're right, right? They're not really a package deal because he is so pathetic. And Lori shows herself to have so much more grit than he has.
And I mean, Laurie does what a lot of people would do, right? Right. She falls for the dash, right? Mm-hmm. She falls for the, I mean, this guy is clean, like most of the men she sees. He cares about his appearance. He's charming. He's interesting. He makes her laugh, you know? So she sees this possibility in him, which is something that happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And then she hangs on to it a little longer than she should.
Yeah.
Right. Which also happens all the time. And then quickly disabused of her notions about him. And then after that, it's tragedy all around. But I don't know. Jake he's so perfectly that guy, that good time guy who just, whenever he gets into trouble, it brings everybody else down somehow. And
yeah,
but when he's up, right?
Yeah. I can't remember if it was Gus who said something about Jake, you know, like, no, Jake is not going to take care of anybody. You're going to be taking care of Jake.
Right. Yes. That's exactly right. And then Jake. And then the things that happen when he's with that little outfit of outlaws. The
Suggs brothers, yeah.
Oh my God. It's awful. And he's just justifying his way through it. And then,
I mean, at some point he's rightly terrified to try and run, right?
Sure.
Because what is the name of the guy that they have? Dogface.
Oh, Dogface. You know, I forgot about him.
He's described as being very scary. And then, I mean, even like with that group, Dogface ends up getting shot, mm-hmm. and then they scalp him and castrate him. And there's some just horrific violence in this book.
Horrible.
But
yeah. I mean, I don't have a lot of sympathy for Jake and his inability to escape from these guys because he knew, you know, like these guys had a reputation and he knew who they were. And so the minute he leaves that, you know, saloon with them, he's sealed his fate. You know, my God, he like walks up to that woman and they stop at some outfitter and he starts hitting on a girl who's very clearly with somebody else.
Yeah.
And he kills another guy. Like, mm-hmm. God, Jake.
Yeah. And, you know, he kind of gets dragged in and I do love that, you know, his death hits pretty hard too, though, even though like, you're like,
it sure does.
It's a piece of crap.
It sure does.
But he's so drunk by the time it comes around that he's just like, wait, there's something that I could say to get myself off the hook here. And he can't think of it.
And then poor Newt is like, Newt loves Jake. Yeah. You know, he just thinks the world
of
him.
He's the cool uncle, right?
Exactly. And just awful. And Carl and Gus having to be the ones to hang him, like, is this weird little full circle moment that no one wanted to be a part of. You know? Yeah. I don't know.
I thought it was interesting. There's some parallelism between when Jake is on the horse about to ride the gallows.
Meet his end.
Yes. Gus says to him, I think, you know, you'd like to know that I got Laurie back. And he's so foggy at that point. He says, who?
Who? Oh, man.
And then Laurie doesn't really remember Jake either. And there's an interesting parallel there.
Oh man. These poor people and their trauma.
There's so much trauma.
There's so much trauma.
Yeah.
I do think Laurie is a character I've previously had an issue with, I think, because so much of what we get about her is how men see her. And for a long time that bugged me. Cause if you read any of Larry McMurtry's other books, he has this tendency to be that guy who describes every aspect of a woman's body, but you never get any description of any man in the book. Is that kind of thing?
Right. She breasted boobily.
Exactly. And so, I want to give him credit because I know that this book is well written and I feel like possibly he did that on purpose because that is what she was to a lot of these people. It's just mm-hmm. something pretty to look at and something to use, you know, not necessarily in a malicious way, but I mean, some people in a malicious way, but you know, it's just, she represented some symbol. She wasn't a person. Right.
Right.
And she saw herself like her perception of herself was so, what's the word I'm looking for? It's so small, you
diminished,
know, like
yeah.
what she could do and where she could go and her relationship with other people. And it's just like, it's not until she gets up to Clara's that she starts to kind of bloom a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, Gus, she kind of does with Gus a little bit, but that's a weird relationship too, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I don't know. Laurie, I'm still trying to figure out how I feel about her as a character. Right. I don't know.
Yeah. It kind of, there's the whole thing with Dish, right? Where he's this extremely capable cowboy who's like their, mm-hmm. like their top hand. Right. And he's pining after Laurie, but he's using her, right? He's seeing her as an object to possess.
He doesn't know her.
No, No, she's just beautiful. Yeah.
And she wouldn't talk to him, and she wouldn't go with him. Right. So she,
hard to
so
get.
He, yeah. It's a little hard to get. It's a little bit like, yeah, there's nothing there that's real. I don't think.
Yeah.
I mean, he does go to Nebraska eventually, and they do spend a little more time together, but it's not like she's chummy with him. Right.
Right.
So he's still sort of chasing this ideal that has nothing to do with who she really is.
And I feel like she can't submit to that. She can't admit, you know, she can't pair up with him at any point, or she will be admitting that she is what he thought of her.
Yeah. Something like that. Like if she's with him, she is always going to be the girl in the room over the saloon. Right.
Mm-hmm.
In a real way.
Yeah. I thought there was a good quote from Gus, because here Jake is really sensitive to anybody saying anything about Lori, to, you know, intimating what her profession is or anything like that. He won't stand for it, right? He'll fight somebody. And Gus at some point is like, well, I guess you're going to have to fight Jake for it. You know, you probably, neither of you would hit each other if you shot at each other, but somebody might hit a horse.
So don't do it. Yeah. Oh my God. Can you imagine a duel between Jake and Dish? That'd be so funny.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Clara is great.
She's the real hero.
And I liked, like, you know, she married this guy who Gus, of course, had no respect for because he's a stay at home guy. Right.
She always knows where he is. Man.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what she says. I'll always know where he is.
Always know where he is, which is also a decision a lot of people make.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she made the right call in not marrying Gus. He's not particularly, I don't think he's husband material.
Was he capable, do you think, of being faithful to one woman?
I don't know. He said he was married twice before, right? Who knows what happened there? I don't think so. I don't think fidelity is a thing that Gus is interested in, right? Mm-hmm. I think he's interested in what he thinks Clara is, right? This beautiful girl that he knew in Texas or wherever they were, and who could, you know, go toe to toe with him and was, you know, a little spitfire or whatever, right? But he doesn't want to have a day in, day out. Like, he doesn't want to, that's why he never went to see her. You know, he didn't want to be her friend. And you have to be the friends with the person you're married to at a certain point.
It's interesting too, though, because, you know, she clearly still has affection for Gus and loves talking with him because her husband was just a few words. Right?
He was Bob.
Yeah. Yeah. It is quite sad. Her whole situation, right? Having lost three sons and then her husband gets kicked in the head by a horse and is essentially brain dead. And that's bad. And she's basically like, okay, heart closed for indefinitely.
Yeah.
And I like the way she treats July, because of course July falls head over heels for her.
Jesus, July Jackson.
And I like that, you know, he kind of backs into a proposal almost. Would you ever think about marrying me?
Would you ever think about marrying me?
Yeah. And she's like, ask me in a year.
No.
Here in the doghouse.
I mean, she doesn't say no. Yeah. But yeah, I think that Clara's another interesting, because, you know, if I always think about this book in the terms of what Western trope are we breaking down here? Like, what are we doing here? And Clara is, you know, she's a homesteader, you know, she's Little Miss Prairie. She's got her idyllic little wooden frame house that everybody wants. And she's got a bunch of beautiful horses. There's a river going by. I mean, it's like everything is picture perfect, right? But it's not, right? Extremely hard. She has to work all the time to make what is happening there function. And she's trying to bring beauty in the house, you know, with the piano, and she tries to plant her flowers, and she likes to make cake, and she still tries to, I think, live a little, right? Which is,
But not too much. But not too much. She's even pretty cold with her daughters until Lori shows up, and Lori kind of helps her, you know, come back to herself a little.
Yeah. I'd be interested. That's one of the interesting things I think would be to read the prequels to see what she was like before, you know, she went off with Bob and tried to make their life. Right. But she's lost children. She's got a husband. She doesn't know what, I mean, he's a vegetable. I don't know if that's a word of excuse, but he's for all intents and purposes dead. Right.
Yeah.
And I don't see her as a tragic figure, but I do see her as, no, it's not Little House on the Prairie. This is actually what we're doing.
Yeah. And you know, she takes no crap. And when July shows up, she's like, great, I can put you to work.
Right.
Are you any good with horses? No. Okay. Well, get good with horses. And so then when Dish shows up, right, he's great with horses. Right. And so he's going to be very useful.
So July's all jealous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Clara. I read yeah. Someone said Clara combines all the male and female virtues, able to break horses and cuddle babies. I think Clara is the Larry McMurtry Lonesome Dove version of the cool girl. She's like,
yeah,
she can like watch sports, but also bake you a cake, you know, like she's the full package. but you can't talk about Clara unless you talk about Clara and Call, I don't think.
Oh, yeah.
Because Call, she hates.
Yes.
And I feel like she is one of the only people in the book who sees Call for who he is, right? I think even, I mean, Gus has this little weird codependent relationship with him. I'm not sure Gus sees Call for really what he is, but but Clara's got his number. And she, and I think at some point in the book, they say something like, Call is the one man you don't boss or something like that, right? And, that applies to everybody but Clara, sorry. she will go after him. And there is something sad about her going after him so hard when he's taking Gus's body to Texas, but at the same time, she's right. Like, go back.
She's totally right.
Go back. Yeah. Leave him here. He don't know. Go back to your son. And he's like, oh, I can't do it. Oh, my God.
Well, I mean, so some of that I understand, right, where Call still has this hang up from way back in his past. And so the fact that Gus wanted to be buried in this place that's a hang up from his past.
Sure.
That makes sense to Call, right?
Sure. But again, it is perfectly... absolutely what his character would do. It is so frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and he, you know, to his credit, right. He says to Gus, like, well, how about I just take you over to Clara's and we can bury you there.
And
right?
Gus said, no,
that makes more sense. And Gus says no. And
I mean, sure. He's honoring what his friend requested. There is a certain amount of, you can have respect for that. You know, I mean, it's not an easy journey. He agrees to take it. Although I don't know how hard it was for him to really leave the ranch. I'm not sure he was really into staying there, but he agreed to do that for Gus before he was willing to acknowledge he had the son, right? And now that he has in his heart acknowledged to himself that he has the son, I don't know. That seems like it should trump everything, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I agree.
Oh, also, my other favorite thing about Call's trip down south with Gus's body is that when he gets back to Lonesome Dove, he goes to the town and he finds out, this is real spoiler, this is like the end of the book, but he goes, it ends on such a weird note, right? He goes to the town. He finds out that Wants, who owned the saloon, went inside, locked himself in, and burnt it down because he couldn't have Lori, right? And there is something very interesting to me about this final idea of this person who could not get this woman that he was pining after blowing his life up, essentially, and how brilliantly that shows exactly what Call just did, right?
Yes.
It's the same thing. And it's, and Call probably sees it as sort of pathetic, which is ironic, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And like the last line of the book is, right? They say he missed that whore. And I read it and it was really jarring to me just because I was used to the miniseries ends with somebody coming and saying, oh, they say you're a man of vision, right? And he kind of thinks back over the whole thing. It's a television ending. It makes sense for that. And so that's what I was expecting. And it happens earlier in the novel, where here it drops that line. And I was like, what the hell? You know? and then I'm like, oh, that's talking about Call. So it took me a minute. And then, exactly. I was like, okay. It's about somebody who blew their life up. Because of unrequited love.
But it's also such a perfect ending. It's like, they go on this trip for no reason. And he comes back to Lonesome Dove and everything is the same. And he's going to go back to the ranch. Everything's going to be the same. You know, it's there's a mundanity to it that is kind of perfect for the vibe of the book. I don't know. If it had ended on some grandiose thing, I don't know if I would have liked it as much.
Yeah. A couple other good lines. One after Gus has rescued Lori, and you know, it talks about everything that she goes through, and it's absolutely terrible. And somebody asks about Lori, is she going to be okay? And he says, she won't forget it, but she may outlive it. And I thought that's a perfect line for that.
I think about sometimes Gus rescuing Lori, and it talks about how he sort of didn't treat her any different, right? He goes and rescues her. And they have to make their way back to where they came from, right? And so they're sort of, but he holds up with her for a little while in this broken down house. And it talks about how she didn't say anything, but he just kept talking to her like they were having a conversation, right? Mm-hmm. I have mixed feelings about that, because on the one hand, it's like, you know, good, you know, she probably needs some she needs to be helped back into the real world, right? Because something so awful has just happened to her. And Gus is a very gentle reentry, I think, in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah.
But also, it sort of, like, his in his mind, he's thinking about the horrors that she just went through. But outwardly, he's almost ignoring it, right? Which is, I don't know if that's good or not. But I guess these aren't people who talk about their traumas too much. So maybe it's the way it should be. But
yeah, not a lot of therapy.
No. My Lord, everybody in this book needs therapy so much.
I mean, you know, Call has his, like, you know, he goes up in solitude away from the rest of the group, right? That's
with the hell bitch.
And I totally get that, right? Like, that's what my brown chair is for. That's I go there and I put a baseball game on and I read a book.
Yeah.
And that's my personal time. Yeah. A funny line from pretty early in the book, and I don't remember who Gus was. I think this is the narrator actually saying this about a character. It says, he had a mustache no thicker than a shoestring and a horse that was not much thicker than the mustache.
I wonder who that's about. I can't remember who that's about. I love that.
Yeah, I don't remember who it was about. But
that reminds me of July and Roscoe, though, because July, we haven't really talked about July and Roscoe, but those two guys, it took me two readings of this book, I think, to even begin to understand why they were in it, right? Their situation is so different than what's going on with Gus and Call. And I don't know if there's some, I still am not sure I fully get what's happening with them, but I think there's something about these two men coming from the city who are wholly unprepared for what the Texas wilderness is going to bring them, right?
Yeah.
And how, and what happens to them, right? How this world chews you up and spits you out, right? And if you're, if you're a sensitive soul at all, or someone who's not prepared to go, you know, guns a-blazing into a Indian camp or whatever. Yeah, it's a harsh place. And and they have all these opportunities to not do what they're doing, right? They have all these opportunities to decide not to do the fruitless thing they're doing. And they can't ever choose not to do it. And it is this inexorable march towards something awful. And it's hard.
Yeah, July in a lot of ways is tragic that way. And you have the pairing of him with Roscoe. And, you know, Roscoe makes July look pretty capable, because Roscoe is just lazy.
He's
useless,
riding his horse into wasp nests, and he can't catch anything to eat, and he's just useless. Bless his heart.
But you know, July can't be introspective enough to go, Elmira left because she wanted to leave, and I don't need to go after her.
Man, Roscoe though, I think one of the interesting things about Roscoe is, you know, he's painted as this fumbling guy who's useless, right?
Yeah.
But Janie sees him as a savior, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He is wholly unthreatening to her, and that is exactly what she needs. And I think it's interesting that these traits that are so reviled in this world, right, are perfect for someone who's been hurt, right? So I there's something there with those two guys. There's something to that, I think, with these two guys. Yes. There's something about them bringing this softness into this Western world. And are they the new West? Who knows? I don't know. It's
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they just have a very different brand of masculinity than the rest of these guys.
Definitely. Yeah. And there's a side character named Louisa or Loiza.
Oh man. I love her.
That is a farmer. And
she has so much cornbread.
I think so much cornbread. Yeah. And I love her line, men are about as worthless a race of people as I've ever encountered.
And she's like,
and she like ambushes him with sex as well. So.
I mean, poor Ron. I don't think Roscoe had ever done that before. A jarring entry into the world of sex, I think. But you know, she's sort of like, you know what? You're fine. You're not going to hurt me. You'll stick around. You're like, come on, let's just do this. Yeah. And
I can put you to work.
I know. And Roscoe, in a lot of ways, would probably be great, like very good off, like do well with her, you know, because she can just do things for him. Because bless.
Well, yeah, and I think he is the kind of person who would do well to be directed by someone.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Which is probably why July liked Elmira too, and why he likes Clara. You know, these are two people who aren't sure of themselves. You know, and so being around people who are sure of themselves, it's got to be very attractive.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't know because I'm very sure of myself. So,
yeah.
Just kidding.
One thing that I had noted down is though, even though Lori's experience is horrific and everything, like the kind of detail that you like get in A Game of Thrones for some of that kind of stuff is not here. Not, you know, right. Mercury pulls back from it and it's all in your mind. And that's bad enough, right? You don't have to have any prurient discussions of it.
Yeah. I wouldn't call anything in this book prurient unless some of the killings maybe, but yeah. Like the way there's one guy in that gang that they do awful things to.
Oh yeah. Cause he's got shot. Right.
Yeah. And then,
and he has the gall to tell them to, you know, stop interfering with Lori.
Right.
Yeah. Ugh. Sorry. That's the euphemism.
Interfering. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh man. I think that's another problem I kind of had with the character of Lori, right? Is that she exists as an object for men. Right. And then then her function in the plot is to get stolen and hurt.
Right.
And then it's only, and then after that, she's just such a mouse. Right. Which for good reason. Right.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't decide if I thought she was a well-drawn character or not. And I still don't know. I still don't know what side I come down on. I'm not as, I don't dislike her as aggressively as I did the first time I read this book, but I think I have a little more empathy in me now, but I'm not sure. I'm still not sure. I don't know if we get as much insight into her as we do some of the other people in the book. But.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly the things that transpire are realistic things that happened. And
that's what everybody says when they write a book that has rape in it. They're like, no, I had to, because that's what happens. It's like, no, in fact, you did not. You could have
done
something else. You could have made any other choice. But I mean, I guess he's trying to show how bad this Blue Duck guy is, I guess. And then let Gus be heroic, I suppose. But it's.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a point in the book where there's two women who are MacGuffins, right? Elmira and Lori that are.
Yeah.
Moving men in the direction they need to go.
They are. And I said in the beginning that I like that in a way, because like these are men who would never in a million years admit that they made any choice because of a woman, right?
Right, right.
But that's exactly what's happening all the time.
Yeah.
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 Oh, this reminds me of something I read. So I was thinking about masculinity in this book. I have a lot of thoughts about that. But when I was just Googling around various, I don't know, words that had to do with Lonesome Dove to see what I got. And I was thinking about how stunted these men were and how at one point Clara has to teach her kid that men cry to, you know, and they have all this tenderness and they don't know what to do with it. And I was really mulling this over and I ran across. There's a podcast called the Hard Men Podcast. And the blurb for their episode about Lonesome Dove was, in this episode, we talk about how Juli Johnson embodies the failures of the soft Mr. Nice Guy. We also talk about practical steps to stand up to your wife, which is the only recipe for a happy home. I was like, well, it's good to know that none of these tropes are gone. We could write this book today. It'll still be fine.
Yeah. No, I grew up in evangelical Christianity enough to know that, yeah, a lot of that stuff is very much still the mainstream.
I mean.
I think I've come to the end of my scattershot notes here. I was strongly considering, as soon as I finished the book, just starting it again.
I get that.
I decided to move on to something else.
I was truly bereft when I finished this book. I was like, well, now what? I can't, I don't want to read anything else. I want to keep reading that.
I was very glad that the next book I read was very different because anything, I feel like, you know, just a regular old novel would have just been like, oh, that was lame.
Wait, so what did you read?
I read Declare. By Tim Powers.
Never heard of that.
It's a World Fantasy Award winner.
Okay, cool.
And it was significantly different. It was a spy novel mixed with eldritch horror and stuff. It's really good, but very, very different than Lonesome Dove. So it didn't engage the same parts of the literary brain. And so
I think I finished reading A Fire Upon the Deep, and then I read The Rose Code, I think. Which honestly, Rose Code's a little fluffy, so it was kind of perfect, actually. It was like, it was a little fluffy, and yet I cried the whole book.
I read a bunch of graphic novels after I finished this first, just to be perfect. I'm gonna let my brain keep thinking about this for a while.
I did. The only other thing I wanted to talk about was I do want to talk about the Latin verse on. So
yes.
So Gus makes this insane sign for their Hat Creek Emporium of whatever, and he puts this Latin phrase on it, which I'm going to mispronounce, but it says "Uva uvam vivendo." Varia fit. Okay. And the internet loves to talk about this because some people say it doesn't make any sense. Like it's just nonsense. It's not real Latin. Mm-hmm. There are other people who say different, but the people who don't think it's real Latin say that it means a grape changes when it lives with another grape, which is sort of like,
iron sharpens iron.
Or no, more like one bad apple ruins the bunch.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
The word kind of becomes inconsistent or unsteady or it ripens, it changes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If it lives with another grape, right? But then there's this other person who says, no, what it means is a grape becomes mottled by being a grape. And he says it's the nature of the grape to do this. This is how it ages, right? It becomes mottled and it ages. This is who it is. It can't change it. That's what happens. And it's a way of saying sort of character is destiny, right? You can't be anybody other than who you are, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of perfect. And you can't, and much like pigs, pigs remain true to themselves, right? We have not, like goats and donkeys, that's different. But pigs, we don't rent pigs because pigs are true to themselves. And I think it's all a big metaphor for how people...
How men are pigs? Is that what you're saying? Is that where you're getting...
I'm not going to say no, but also you can change a lot, but you don't fundamentally change, right? You don't change, you get more so, right? That's I think my friend Rachel put it that way one time. You don't change, you get more so. And that's kind of what's happening to all the people in this book, right? They're just sort of unrelentingly being themselves and making the choices no matter what that they have to make. So I feel like that stupid Latin nothing phrase is like the perfect the perfect little bow on the book to me.
Yeah. You said over email. I think if I was going to title an episode about this book, it would be well, 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 if it isn't the consequences of my own actions.
Man, I'm right. I was right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so true though. It's like, man, consequences are coming for you. You think they are not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we can all only do our best, right? That's the thing. Like we can all only make the choice in front of us with the information we have, according to the person we are. And that's, for better or worse, what these folks are doing. And we get to go along on the ride.
In the end, to thine own self be true, unless you're Call, in which case be better.
Right. or I saw, I think I saw a poster on Etsy that was like, how it was like, be who you are, unless you could be Gus. In that case, be Gus.
Oh, I've seen that with Batman.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I don't know if I'd want to be Gus, honestly, but
I don't know. Yeah. The realities of some of the kind of rough living that they did, you know, where they had nothing but jerky to eat for weeks on end.
But also he's never going to be happy. There's nowhere that will ever live up to what he wants. Right. So he's just doomed to roam until he can't walk, in which case, goodbye, Gus.
Yeah.
Gus.
Yeah. No,
I am in love with him though. You know. Don't get it twisted. I am in love with Gus. Everybody's in love with Gus. Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously. Even Dish, I think, is in love with Gus in some sense. Yeah. I mean, really, a lot of the guys are kind of in love with Call too, right? Because he's so stinting with his praise, right?
Yeah.
He tells somebody, well done, you know.
It's like a drop of water in the desert.
Yes. It's like the people in Mad Max Fury Road, you know.
Yeah.
Where Immortan Joe lets the water out, you know. Do not become addicted to water.
And Call, he couldn't pull that off if he wasn't competent, right? Like he's a very competent man, and so it works, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know, Call.
Yeah, His feelings when they come out are kind of explosive too, right? Because he sees that guy abusing Newt at one point and just goes off.
That scene, I think, is the beginning of Call sort of understanding what Newt is to him, right? Because that's not just him going off. That's him protecting his kid, right? That's Mama Bear is what that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Holy crap. He went to town on that guy too.
Yeah.
That guy was not okay.
No. And I like the way Gus just kind of rolled corrals over to him. The other soldiers and was like, collect your dude and get out of here.
Yeah. And then he just corrals him with his horse. He's like, call, it's me. Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff. And this is definitely one that I'll reread. That's another reason that I wanted to purchase it in physical, you know, because I want it on my bookshelf. I want somebody to ask me about it. I want to be like, oh, you should borrow this here.
Book as object. Book as. Yes. Maybe we should get ourselves a nice leather bound copy.
There we go. So I've not read any of the rest of the series. You said you had read a sequel.
I read 10 pages of the sequel and got mad.
Okay.
So I have never read anything else in the series. And I think it's the same reason. One of my very favorite albums of all time, Seth, is In the Airplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel. And for decades, I could not listen to any of their other albums because I love that album so much that I didn't want my vision of them to change. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's how I feel about these people in this book. Like I want to freeze them in amber. Right. I don't want them I don't want to know anything else about them in a way.
Yeah. I get that.
I'm sure they're good. I've heard mixed reviews about the other books. You know, it's hard to capture lightning in a bottle twice. So,
yeah, I mean, coming off a book that's as brilliant as this one, it's difficult to think, could he do that more than once? You know,
I mean, he's a good writer. He's got other awards under his belt.
Yeah.
But
and I will say for anybody who's looking this up, right, you look it up on Goodreads. It says like, you know, I can't remember what
it's like. Book three in the Streets of Laredo or whatever, or Comanche Moon trilogy or whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And so don't be fooled by that. It is the first book that was written in this series. And
it's,
so,
I mean, in some ways, it's the only book that was written in its own series. Yeah. Those other books are in a different series. That's what I say.
There we go. Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that then.
Okay.
Final thoughts. I mean, obviously, we're both recommending this one.
Oh, I'm definitely. I recommend this book to everyone. I saw someone on the internet describe it as the Lord of the Rings for America, which I think, in a way, is kind of true. They're sort of plodding along on this journey. So, in the Star Wars or Lord of the Rings universe, it's definitely Lord of the Rings.
It's definitely Lord of the Rings. Yeah. I vastly preferred Lonesome Dove to the Lord of the Rings, though, I have to say. just in terms of readability.
I mean, it doesn't have Tom Bombadil, so it's got that going for it.
Oh, goodness. And there's really not any songs either.
Yeah, no songs. You know, no,
I'm well known as an anti-Tom Bombadil guy.
We didn't even talk about the Irish guys. There's no songs, but you do know that the Irish guys are off in the moonlight serenading the cows with the saddest songs they can think of Ireland.
Yes. Until one of them dies crossing a river.
Oh, my God. That's the worst. That's one of the worst deaths.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah. That does not sound fun.
No. Also, it's almost impossible for that to actually happen. So good news.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he presents it as a fluke, right?
Right.
Because there had just been a really bad storm.
Right.
And so the water was high and
everything
was terrible.
Pointless death. Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we'll leave it there. So thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah.
Amy.
It's great. Thanks for having me.
I almost called you Lori.
That's okay.
We
all answered each other's names. It's fine.
Yeah. But there was a Lori in this book as well.
Oh, that's true.
Any contact info you want to give out? Where can people find you?
Me nowhere, but the Hugo Girl podcast, which I highly recommend. I'm not biased at all. You can find them at Hugo Girl podcast on Instagram. Blue Sky, I think, same thing. I don't think we do Twitter anymore. And we have a website, hugogirlpodcast.com. And you can find us on all of your podcast applications that you use.
A hilarious podcast. That's the last thing I hear in every episode. All right. Well, Amy, thanks so much for doing this. This was a ton of fun. Thank you for inviting me to read this book. And I have a hard time believing I'm going to read as good of another book ever. So
you won't. You're ruined.
Yeah, I think I am. I think this is over. This is it.
Podcast is done. You've reached the pinnacle. Congratulations.
Yes. I guess I will now have to wrap up the book and drive it back to where I started, which was here. So
bury it in Texas at Clara's Orchard.
Sounds good. All right. Bye-bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that diversion from the normal kind of thing that we do here. Still the same kind of thing, just with a different genre of books, in this case, Westerns. And I hope we convinced you that it's an absolutely tremendous book. And if you want a long book that is a pleasure to read, Lonesome Dove is a good one. And I don't think I have much more to say. You know, by the time this goes up, Worldcon will be over. So who knows what happened there. So be sure to check out Hugo Girl if you have not in the past. We didn't really talk about what Hugo Girl is, but I presume a lot of the people who have listened to one or the other podcast knows about the other. So we'll be back to science fiction programming in the next episode. So thank you so much, as always, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.